James Yi was a West Point graduate and a Muslim imam when he agreed to serve as the Muslim chaplain at Guantanamo Bay Prison. In 2003, he was arrested on what turned out to be false charges of espionage and treason, but he was held in solitary confinement for 76 days before being cleared and given an honorable discharge and a commendation. He wrote about his experience in his book, For God and Country. James Yi is in Wisconsin this weekend for the National Veterans for Peace Convention being held in Madison, and he joins us this morning to talk about his experiences as an American Muslim veteran, also about peace building, both as a veteran and as a Muslim. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Welcome to 45 North, and James, it's so great to have you here.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Thanks. Well, Guantanamo is back in the news this week. This week marks the six-month anniversary of the prisoners' hunger strike. Can you just start by reminding us what that's all about?
Well, it seems as if the prisoners started a hunger strike back in February, and that hunger strike pretty much is to protest the indefinite detention that has been going on in Guantanamo since the very early stages of its inception back in 2002. The hunger strike last month grew to a peak number of, I think it was 104 or 106, with many of the prisoners being force-fed. Ramadan started last month also, and then the numbers kind of tailed off, dropped off a little bit. But still, today, there's still about 50 or 60 on hunger strike, with perhaps about 40 being force-fed by the military.
Which is a really brutal experience.
It's rough and it's very painful. And actually, when I was in Guantanamo back in 2003, there were two prisoners in the detainee hospital who were being force-fed daily. Not because they were on hunger strike, but because they were so depressed, they had no appetite, they refused to eat, and they were being kept alive because their body weight had just deteriorated to much below 100 pounds.
Mm-hmm. Now, why did the prisoners want to stop the hunger strike during Ramadan?
So I would think that some of the prisoners wanted to be able to participate in the rigorous worship routine that often goes with Ramadan, the praying, the fasting, and breaking the fast at sundown.
And maybe they didn't want to be force-fed during Ramadan. Maybe
exactly.
They would feel that was also breaking their fast at an inappropriate time.
The military did make accommodation and agreed to even do the force-feeding of those who refused to come off the hunger strike in the evenings. But still, those who really wanted to engage in the worship aspects of Ramadan perhaps felt that it would be much easier if they break their hunger strike. Some are anticipating that the numbers of the hunger strike are going to go back up now that Ramadan just ended.
Yeah. Now, it's been a while since you were at Guantanamo. How do you think, but you keep up with what's going on, how do you think conditions now, how different are they from what it was like when you were there?
There's some good and some bad. I believe that when President Obama took office, one of the things that he did was he mandated a complete review of prisoner treatment. And I believe after that time, a lot of the physical types of abuse, a lot of the very harsh interrogation tactics that was authorized during the Bush administration were stopped. However, the other aspects of keeping prisoners indefinitely without charge, without trial, seems to be institutionalized by the Obama administration. So that, no doubt, is torturous as well.
Mm. And do you think, I mean, we were talking about the military trying to make adjustments to the force feeding in observation of Ramadan. I mean, you were in Guantanamo as the Muslim army chaplain. Does that suggest to you that the army is more understanding of Islam, making more adjustments for the prisoners' faith?
Well, to be honest, when I first got that assignment to go down to Guantanamo, I really didn't know what my particular role was going to be once I got down there. I actually speculated that I was being sent to Guantanamo because I felt that perhaps the Department of Defense, the Pentagon, they wanted to say, look, we're sending our Muslim chaplain down here. That means we're accommodating the prisoners' religious faith. We're being humane. Mm-hmm. We're treating these prisoners appropriately. But of course, when I got down there, that was just not the case.
What do you mean? What did you see?
Oh, of course, the rampant abuse and the horrible conditions at that time. Camp Delta was filled with prisoners in these cage-like cells. The interrogation tactics were really harsh, humiliating prisoners sexually by female interrogators to persecution of the prisoners' faith in those interrogation rooms. Those reports were rampant, and I would hear a lot of that directly from the prisoners in my interactions with them. And I raised those concerns to the command.
You must have felt in such a strange situation. I mean, you were employed by the Army, but you were there as a Muslim chaplain to minister to the men, to the prisoners. I mean, what did you think your role was going to be?
Well, first of all, a chaplain in the military's primary role in general is to defend religious rights of U.S. service members who are in the armed forces, of civilians who might be employed on a military installation, and even prisoners who might be incarcerated by the U.S. military, even on the mainland in military prisons. So going down to Guantanamo, I did understand that my role as the prison chaplain was to defend the religious rights of the prisoners to the extent possible, as well as ensure that there's accommodation of religious practices for these prisoners. So that, for me, that was a given.
Yeah, but then you wound up, I mean, some of the things you complained about, which I know are still complaints, prisoners were complaining that the Quran was being desecrated. Mm-hmm. Guards were coming in, searching cells, throwing the Quran on the floor. I mean, did you feel that the Army was sort of systematically and from a fairly high up level discriminating against Muslims and against Islam?
Oh, sure. The amount of abuse that was going on in the very early stages really particularly pointed towards the prisoners being persecuted for their faith. There were so many things that was going on that indicated that it was the Muslim faith that was being targeted.
What?
In terms of the desecration of the Quran, that was something that upset many of the American Muslims who were serving in Guantanamo as translators and other roles. Some of them came to me with these concerns as well. But there were other things, like, for example, sometimes guards would want to instigate the prisoners at times, so they might turn the water spigots in the prison cells off right before prayer time. Therefore, the prisoners wouldn't have an opportunity to wash before the prayer.
Which is important.
Things like that. The desecration of the Quran was done because military interrogators, military intelligence, and federal intelligence agents down in Guantanamo understood that the Quran is a book that is considered by Muslims all over the world to be the literal words of God, and therefore in abusing it, in disrespecting it, they thought that that would help them put pressure on the prisoners and help and aid these interrogators in getting information.
So it wasn't just an accidental, we're going to come in and shove a lot of stuff on the floor. It was a very deliberate
On the part of some people, but then there were some who just wanted to instigate, and that happened as well.
Mm. You know, you were there at a time when the war on terror was beginning, wasn't that long after 9/11, and there was so much anti-Muslim sentiment abroad in the U.S. then. Do you think that, and many popular misconceptions about Muslims as well, do you think that that's changed at all?
To some extent, yes, and to some extent, no. I remember at one time, not long after 9/11, reading in the media that stores like Barnes & Noble could not keep copies of the Quran on the shelf. Mm. And so people were really interested in wanting to learn about Islam, to find out what is this religion and why is it that this religion, in their minds, thought that dictated attacking America. But Throughout the last decade, I've also heard from my interactions with Muslims in different communities across the nation that the number of Muslims continue to increase, and there's still a lot of people converting to Islam after learning about what the religion really is.
And what's the situation like for Muslims in serving in the military now?
I would say that Muslims who serve within the U.S. military no doubt face unique challenges. Of course, in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, most Muslims, I would say, and many of them came to me with concerns, that at many times their loyalty was questioned by their comrades, by others in the military. Even in Guantanamo, the guard force, the infantry security guard force down in Guantanamo, that was responsible for the physical security of the prison, there was a Muslim who was a part of that team, and when I found out from him that his commander refused to post him in the wooden guard towers that oversee the prison camp because he was Muslim, under the idea that, you know, because he was Muslim and if there was a prisoner who was able to escape, that he might not, you know, perform his duty and allow that prisoner to get away. I offered, of course, to intervene. Mm. However, the soldier said, well, you know, several blocks of hours in the hot humidity of Guantanamo, up in the wooden,
that's okay.
Guard tower,
he's okay taking a pass.
Can get quite uncomfortable, and he's like, you know, that's a duty that no one really wants to pull. And he said it kind of worked in his favor anyway. But but the idea behind it is that the commander was discriminating him solely based on his faith, and he wasn't even a very practicing Muslim.
And did the soldiers you talked with at the time, the Muslim soldiers, did they themselves have reservations about, for instance, serving overseas and having to attack or shoot other Muslims? Was that an issue for them?
Yes. There were some who came to me and basically had questions, because there's a general moral concept in Islam that a Muslim doesn't kill another Muslim. However, I actually heard a sermon by one scholar that said, look, well, it's forbidden for a Muslim to kill anyone anyway, regardless of what faith they are. But there sometimes are particular concerns of Muslims in the military when they get the orders to deploy overseas for a combat mission, whether or not they'll be put into a position where they might have to engage an enemy who might also be of the Muslim faith.
So when guys came to you and said, I'm concerned about this, what would you say?
Basically, I would say that, yes, this is a legitimate concern. Every person has to find for themselves what is right for them to do, whether they, you know, agree to follow that assignment, whether they choose to go AWOL, which some did, or whether they choose to use the regulations where you can apply for a conscientious objector status that would, allow a service member not to be deployed based on conscience. But that's a lengthy process that has to be carried out.
Okay. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with James Yee. He's a former U.S. Army Muslim chaplain stationed at Guantanamo Bay. His book about his time there is called For God and Country, and he's in Wisconsin this weekend for the 2013 Veterans for Peace National Convention. You'll find a link on our Facebook page at 45 North on WPR. Don't forget to friend us while you're there. And we'd love to hear from you. Do you notice discrimination against American Muslims in the U.S. today? And what do you think Islam has to offer American culture today? You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234 or email us. The address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Anne Strange Sampson. You're listening to 45 North, and we're talking with James Yee, former U.S. Army Muslim chaplain. And James, I want to talk some more about your own personal story. We've sort of been painting the broad picture of Guantanamo and portrait of Muslims in the U.S. military. But tell us about yourself. You graduated from West Point, so there's clearly something you really like about the military.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I come from a military family. My father, who's also U.S.-born, U.S. citizen, served during World War II. My younger brother is also a West Point graduate, and my other younger brother served as an Army doctor. So all of the men, all of the males in my family have served in the U.S. military, in particular the Army. I went into the U.S. Military Academy back in 1986 and was commissioned in 1990 as an air defense artillery officer, specializing in the Patriot missile system, and was even deployed in the aftermath of the first Gulf during Operation Desert Storm.
Mm-hmm. And you were raised Lutheran, I've read, but then converted to Islam. How did you fall in love with Islam?
Mm-hmm. I was raised Lutheran. My mom raised us all Lutheran. My mom still goes to the local church in Springfield, New Jersey, where I grew up. But I started to read about Islam back in 1991, shortly after I graduated West Point. And interestingly enough, at West Point, I didn't have any classes or courses like any inter-religious courses that taught about different faiths. Mm-hmm. I was Lutheran, but I wasn't very religious. And when I started to read about Islam, what intrigued me was discovering that much of what Muslims believe were things I myself already believed in as a Christian. Hmm. For example, the biblical stories of the prophets like Abraham and Moses and David and Joseph and Noah and the story of his ark. Those are all Islamic stories as well. It was very interesting to learn that Muslims also believe in the virgin birth of Jesus Christ. And that was something that I myself believed in, and that was a very integral part of my faith as a Christian.
But then what did you find in Islam that you hadn't found in Christianity?
I found a simplicity, the simple belief in one God, without this idea of the Trinity, mm-hmm. which is the basis for the Christian doctrine. However, it didn't throw out the concept and belief in Jesus Christ and all of what he did during his life. So, you know, I was able to convert to Islam, transform my faith into just a simple monotheistic belief in one God, but yet maintain pretty much all of the Christian concepts that I learned going to Sunday school as a Christian.
That's so interesting, because it sounds as though for you it wasn't so much a leaving one faith as it was opening up a new window onto the same faith.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that I also took to was the idea of forgiveness in Islam. In practically every chapter of the Quran, it opens with the words Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim in Arabic, and that the translation is in the name of God, the most gracious, most merciful. And God is called the most merciful, the most gracious, because he is all-forgiving to those who ask him for his forgiveness. And in Christianity, the basis for forgiveness comes from believing in Jesus Christ. So there's a strong ideal of forgiveness in both of the faiths. And for me, as a person seeking to improve myself, knowing that, you know, I've sinned in my life, that there's a path towards redemption. And, you know, that was something that I took to as well.
So you wound up, I think you went on pilgrimage to Mecca, and then you wound up studying Islam in Syria under Syria's, I think, the supreme religious leader, am I right? Sheikh Ahmad Kuftaro?
He's what's called the Mufti. He uh-huh. was the Mufti. Uh-huh. He has since passed. He was the Mufti of Syria at that time, appointed by the former president, Hafez Assad, and then served under the current president, Bashar Assad. But I went to an Islamic institution in Syria, and that really broadened my view of Islam. Syria, actually, in terms of religious practice, is very moderate. You find a quick example is the way Muslim women in Syria dress. You see some who are more conservative that wear the hijab, and you might find some that even wear the what's called the niqab, or the veil, which only allows the eyes to show.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are others who might wear a knee-length skirt and still wear the scarf over their head. And then there's some women who choose not to cover at all and dress in jeans and a cashmere sweater. So there's a variety of faith levels in Syria, and in terms of practice, it's very moderate.
It's interesting hearing you talk about this, because partly it's like a flashback to the pre-9/11 world, because this was all before 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
You came back to the U.S., and by then you were one of the first Muslim chaplains in the U.S. Army. How did 9/11 change things?
It changed a lot. Prior to 9/11, well, I came back on active duty actually that same year in January of 2001. And up until September of that year, my time was so much taken up by basic counseling of soldiers, whether it was relationship counseling, marriage counseling, work stress, whether it was individual counseling of soldiers, that took up the predominant aspect, parts of my time as a chaplain, as well as trying to develop what we called the unit spiritual fitness program. But after 9/11, in the immediate aftermath, of course, there were soldiers within my own unit, and we had a handful of Muslims serving, who came to me and said that right off the bat, others in the unit were questioning their loyalty and saying things like, how could you serve in the U.S. military after what Muslims did to the World Trade Center?
What did you say to those guys?
Well, when this news got to the battalion commander, the first thing that he did was he ordered a complete unit training session where he had me talk about what the religion of Islam is and open the floor to questions and answers. And there were so many questions that I addressed on that day. It was like a 2-hour session, and we could have gone much longer if we had the time. And my commander was very impressed, and at his next commander's meeting with the rest of the commanders on the base, he put my name out there and offered my services, I guess you can call it, to other units. And all of a sudden, I started getting these calls from other unit commanders asking me to come and provide training on Islam and Muslim culture to their troops, especially those who were getting ready to deploy.
Well, so you wound up then going down to Guantanamo as Muslim chaplain. And I'm thinking about what a complicated role that must have been. I mean, that you were serving as chaplain to men who shared your faith, but who were suspected of using that faith to justify a religious war against your country. What did you see as your responsibility in that situation?
Well, sure, going down to Guantanamo as a chaplain, really, it wasn't my role really to judge whether someone was guilty or innocent. My role, as I said earlier, was focused on trying to get religious accommodation for the prisoners and to ensure that the prisoners had their rights as individuals, as human beings, to practice Islam to the extent that they could in those cells. But on the other hand, it was quite clear that many of the most of the individuals in Guantanamo at that time were ordinary people who just were in the wrong place at the wrong time and got picked up mostly by non-U.S. forces and sold over to the U.S. military for bounties and then sent to Guantanamo. I often make the point that in 2003, when I was there, there were no hardcore terrorists at Guantanamo Bay. The 660 or so prisoners that were there, I will say that not one of them was in any way connected to 9/11. And I say that because at that time, anyone who was considered a legitimate terrorist suspect were not sent to Guantanamo. They were sent to CIA black sites, which President Bush exposed in 2006 when he actually took those prisoners, 15 to 20 or so, out of those CIA black sites and then moved them to Guantanamo in order for Congress to have legitimate claims to passing what was called the 2006 a Detainee Treatment Act or something like that.
Mm. Well, we should talk some about what happened to you because, you know, here you are, West Point graduate and serving as Muslim Army chaplain, and suddenly you were arrested and charged with espionage, treason. Were you surprised?
Very surprised when I was actually put in handcuffs and then put in prison. And actually, that first night, I pretty much thought it was just a huge misunderstanding, and then we settled this with the commander at Guantanamo, and then I'd be out and on my way. But that didn't happen. Instead, I was held in Jacksonville, in the Jacksonville Naval Air Station prison for a week, and then I was transferred to the Consolidated Naval Brig, where I would then learn that there were what was termed U.S. citizen enemy combatants being held in that prison. Individuals like Jose Padilla, Yasser Hamdi, Yasser Al-Mari, individuals who were being held in the war on terror who either held U.S. citizenship or had been taken into custody on U.S. soil. They were held in the Consolidated Naval Brig in Charleston, South Carolina, and that's where I was sent.
So you went from ministering to prisoners to being one yourself and being held in the same conditions.
Exactly. And even in being transported to the Consolidated Naval Brig from Jacksonville, I was at times subjected to what's termed sensory deprivation, where I had those blackened out goggles put on my eyes. I had the devices similar to these earphones that I'm wearing now over my ears, but preventing me from hearing. And I was chained and shackled in the same way that prisoners at Guantanamo were shackled at the wrists, the waist, and the ankles. So I immediately understood I was being treated like a terrorist. And that struck fear in me because I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know where they were taking me. And I didn't know if I was ever going to be seen again.
Did you think this was because you were a Muslim? Do you think that's why you were targeted?
No doubt that my faith, being a Muslim, played a role. But I also know today that it was raising concerns about conditions and mistreatment of prisoners at Guantanamo that was also a catalyst. But at the same time, I will also say that my ethnicity, being Chinese American, somewhat played a role. As someone would label me a Chinese Taliban during that time when I was in prison.
Hmm. I'm curious, how did your faith inform how you reacted to that whole experience? I mean, were there particular teachings that you drew on as you tried to have enough strength just to get through 76 days in solitary confinement?
Yeah, sure. The first is having trust in God, that there is a divine plan for all things that happen. And there's a verse in the Quran that states, verily, you may dislike something, but in it there is much good. So as much as I hated being treated like a terrorist, as much as I hated being wrongfully accused, as much as I hated being in that solitary confinement, and being disappeared from society with my family not knowing what happened to me, ultimately, I can draw back to my faith and know that God has a divine plan. And in some sense, in some manner, God has some good plan to come out of all of this.
Do you still feel that way?
Sure. People go through things for a reason. And I believe I was put through that very harrowing time to test my faith and to ultimately test me as to whether my trust in God would stay strong.
I'm curious about the, now that you have experienced firsthand just how bad discrimination against someone because of their, partly because of their religion, can get. I'm curious about what the personal cost must be for other soldiers, Muslim soldiers, who may feel that because of their faith, they are second-class citizens in the military.
Yes, I mean, you know, Muslims in the military serve in all capacities, and they serve just like anyone else. One of the main role of the chaplain corps in the U.S. military is to ensure that people of all faiths are treated equally, to include Muslims, to include Jews, to include Sikhs, to include Wiccans who might serve the U.S. military. But as I said earlier, no doubt Muslims in the military face unique challenges because there is so many misconceptions about Islam that people perceive Islam as being a religion that actually advocates violence. When actually, when you study the faith, you find that Islam actually advocates tolerance, that there is no compulsion in religion, that other Abrahamic faiths like Christianity and Judaism, members of those faiths are honored people according to the Quran, things like that.
We have a caller on the line. Mark from La Crosse has a question for you. Hi, Mark, are you there?
I am. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I just had a question, kind of. I've been listening to the gentleman, and respect him. I understand what he's saying, but, you know, to me, it seems like he's kind of talking Islam up so much. And, I wanted to get his view on particularly Sharia law. And why is it, when we talk discrimination, how about cultures like Saudi Arabia that are fully embraced by Islam? What happens to the homosexuals in those communities? They're executed. Women aren't allowed to drive in Saudi Arabia. There's mercy killings. These are things that to me are very concerning, especially when you talk it up. And you know, I've done some studying, and I can tell you that Surah 9 verse 5 says to go forth and kill all non-believers wherever you find them, using every strategy of war. And yeah, you could say that's in a war setting, but just a little while ago, the gentleman said that he's heard that Islam is not to kill anybody.
Well, there are you can quote the same kind of things from the Bible too. But James, let's see what your reply is.
Yeah, first of all, he mentioned what do I think of Sharia law? Sharia law, really, if you want to compare it to other faiths, you would compare it to biblical law, you would compare it to Judaic law. It's religious law that teaches a person how to live their life. Sharia law, for example, teaches me to be good to my mother, to respect my parents. As the Prophet Muhammad said, paradise is under the foot of your mothers. That's the Sharia law. It's a guidance for a Muslim on how to live. It teaches you how to pray five times a day. It teaches you how to fast during Ramadan. It teaches you how to be good, honest, upright, and be a contributing person in society. This is what Sharia law. It's not something where some people today are saying, oh, Muslims are trying to implement Sharia law and take over the U.S. Constitution. First of all, that's not possible in our society.
But I think that Mark's question spoke directly to the rights of women and how women are treated in Islamic countries.
And that's true. We're saying Islamic countries. So it's these governments and countries that are on how they're implementing what they perceive to be Islamic law, perhaps incorrectly.
The problem is how they interpret.
There's nothing.
Islam.
There's nothing in the Quran that says, for example, that women can't drive. Actually, during the time of the Prophet, women rode camels, rode donkeys, right? So. This is perhaps a ultra orthodox interpretation or going to the extreme where women, you know, aren't allowed to drive. But on the other hand, with interaction from the United States, for example, at government and cultural levels, from what I understand, that the Saudi royalty actually has a woman who's now a pilot for the royal family. So hopefully things will change there.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with James Yee. He's a former U.S. Army Muslim chaplain who was stationed at Guantanamo Bay. His book about his time there is called For God and Country, and he's in Wisconsin this weekend for the 2013 Veterans for Peace National Convention. You'll find a link on our Facebook page, which is 45 North on WPR. Don't forget to friend us while you're there. And I'm curious, I'd like to hear from some veterans in the next few minutes. What do you think about serving in the military while also criticizing the military? Is there or should there be a dividing line between patriotism and dissent? You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234 or post on our Facebook page, 45 North on WPR. I'm Ann Strangechamps. This is 45 North, and we're talking with James Yee, a former U.S. Army Muslim chaplain who was stationed at Guantanamo Bay. He was arrested and detained on what turned out to be false charges. He was given an honorable discharge and a commendation for meritorious service, but he wrote a book about his time there called For God and Country. And James, I wanted to ask you, you know, we were talking earlier about the, like all religions, Islam speaks very powerfully about peace. As a man of faith, as a Muslim, do you feel that American Muslims have any particular ability or responsibility even to help heal what's the religious divide that's arisen in America as a result of 9/11?
Sure. It's actually incumbent upon Muslims in this country, I believe, to be a part of the move to educate others about what Islam is. Because there's so many misconceptions, because there's so many misunderstandings, the American Muslim community can and have been playing a major role in educating others about Islam, whether it's giving free Qurans out or holding seminars or opening the doors to the Islamic centers and mosques for others to visit and get to know the Muslim community here in America.
And going back to that question about patriotism and dissent, there's a tradition that's especially strong in the military that if you serve, you're a patriot. And patriots don't criticize their country. They don't dissent. But you're from a military family, and other veterans see it differently. How do you see the whole question of is it possible to be a patriot, serve in the military, and also criticize the military?
Sure. I mean, some would say that the highest form of patriotism is dissent. But that dissent is to criticize the government where it might be going wrong. Because ultimately, you want your nation, you want your country to be the best that it can be. And if it's going down the wrong path, then it's up to the people to criticize the leadership, to criticize the president, the Congress, when it might be going down the wrong path. So, yeah, dissent is very important. There are, though, concerns that when you serve in the military, you lose your First Amendment rights. To extent, yes. But as an individual, you have that First Amendment. And you basically, if you're in the military serving and you want to voice your opinions, you have to understand the regulations that are out there, that you speak on behalf of yourself, not as an opinion or a viewpoint of the Department of Defense or the Department of the Army.
Well, so when you were serving, for instance, when you were in Guantanamo and you began raising concerns about the inhumane treatment of the prisoners there, did you get pushback not from your commanders but from other servicemen and women, people on your level?
Well, my raising of concerns was done in this capacity. In Guantanamo Bay, especially when prisoners were abused during interrogations, prisoners came back to the cell blocks and caused riots, created disturbances, fought against the prison guards because of the frustration and the anger of being subjected to abusive tactics. My commander sent me into the cell blocks to find out what's going on. Why are these prisoners refusing to comply? Why are they causing these riots and chaos? And when I found out why, I brought that information to my commander. So he actually valued my input because he now understood what was going on inside the prison cell blocks. And
so you found a way to say, hey, this is wrong, not because it's inhumane or,
but it, because
or
it's,
wrong,
but it's counterproductive to the operation.
Right, mm-hmm. right. To the well, that's sort of a neat end run around the moral question that we were kind mm-hmm. of talking about. What if, I mean, how would your fellow servicemen and women, I guess, what's the feeling when you're in the military about what can you say and what can you not say?
Publicly, of course, no one really gets to speak to journalists or media except those that are appointed or assigned by the command. I was actually someone assigned by the command to talk to journalists that came down to Guantanamo. But you're trained to only cover certain points, and that's the message and the training that the U.S. military gives you. Mm-hmm. Stay on point. Stay on message. So when journalists wanted to know what kind of abuses or how are the prisoners being treated in Guantanamo, my message was, I'm a chaplain down here, and my role is to try and accommodate religious practices, not take responsibility over the command mm-hmm. and things like that. So you're trained in that sense in the public affairs arena down at Guantanamo.
Mm. I want to take a call. We've got Fred on the line from West Bend. Hi, Fred.
Morning.
Hi. Did you have a comment or a question?
Yeah, I have a comment. Back in the late 60s, I served 4 years in the military. And when I was sworn in, I took an oath to serve my country. We knew what we were saying. We knew what we were accepting. We knew what we had to do. And there was no excuse or any reason to change after you've already taken an oath. That's what that oath is. It's an oath. And to think that because I am a Methodist and I don't want to shoot a Methodist that's an enemy is, you know, to me that's grounds for discharge. They shouldn't serve. It's your job under any circumstances, no matter what the occasion is, unless it's an illegal act, to serve your country and follow and obey your orders. And that's what all of us did. When I served, there was none of this about we have to cater to the prisoners because of their religion. And certainly the same prisoners that we are catering to in the United States would never think once about honoring the religion of a Methodist or a Catholic. If they were in a Muslim prison, they might think about beheading them or something to that effect, but they would never cater to them.
Okay, thanks. James, any response?
Yes. Well, yeah, surely those who serve the military are duty-bound to obey lawful orders. But I emphasized lawful. So, for example, in Guantanamo, if someone's being tortured, that is unlawful. And it's actually the duty of every service member, every officer, every individual in the military to report that unlawful behavior. So the point that our caller made, that Fred made, was it's our duty in the military to obey. Yes, but obey lawful orders. The other point that he raised was if you have a change in conscience, he said that, well, perhaps you shouldn't serve. And actually, there's a process in the military called conscientious objector, mm-hmm. where sometimes individuals get deployed to a combat zone and are traumatized or have a change in conscience that they no longer want to be someone who might kill another human being. So that change in conscience is legitimately accepted by the U.S. military, and there's a process to allow that person to be honorably discharged under conscientious objector status.
I guess, you know, one of the questions is if you're serving in the military and you're also a person of great religious faith, those are two sets of moral values, you know, and how do you decide between them? I mean, I think what Fred was saying, you know, you made a decision to serve in the military, so you're saying these moral values trump any others. Am I getting that right?
Well, every person is going to decide for themselves what is moral. What is moral? If you take the title of my book, I entitled it "For God and Country," and that message, the message in that is that for me, there was no divide between serving God and serving my country, right? But it's how do you serve your country, and I tried to do it in a manner that also served God. I believe it was my duty, my responsibility as an American, as a Muslim, as a U.S. citizen, to give back to others, to give back to my country in the way that is right and correct according to, you know, my beliefs.
Did for you was serving in the military also? I mean, I'm thinking about how you come from a military family. Would you say that serving in the military for you is also a kind of faith?
Well, people will say that the military has its own unique culture, and no doubt. There are things that happen in the military that just don't happen on the outside to ordinary civilians in the way of life. So the military has its own unique culture. And I'm learning more of that now as I interact more with veterans, now that I'm out of the military, that many veterans are misunderstood because those who haven't served in the military often don't understand that culture that veterans have adjusted to from being in the military. So yes, there's a unique culture to being a U.S. service member.
I guess I meant sort of more than culture, because I think, you know, you were referring to the title of your book, For God and Country. You put those two things together. Mm-hmm. You know, there's in for you in both, it sounds like there's a deep element of service, you know, of faith. And I was just thinking about or wondering whether you see any similarity between organized religion and the military. I mean, do they have anything in common?
Sure. There's a lot in common. I mean, organized religion basically not only focuses on developing the individual spiritually, but sure, the aspect of service in contributing to society. In the military, I mean, the overall purpose of the military is to defend the nation, you know, in terms of national security. But at the same time, there's encouragement being in the military of serving the country. Now that we have a volunteer army, it's sacrificing your own life or sacrificing your time in order to provide a service, and that service could be a military defense of the nation in its time of need.
Mm-hmm. But both, you know, have in common the task is to subordinate your ego to something larger, to a greater good, something that a way of being of service to your fellow human beings.
Sure.
I guess
in the military we refer to that as selfless service. Serving or giving of yourself without expectation of receiving any reward back.
Has it been, I mean, after all you've been through, can you now find beauty in military service as well as beauty in Islam?
Oh, sure. There are a lot of valuable things that people gain from being in the military, a particular skill set, training, discipline. I was a lot more disciplined in terms of my physical activity and doing, you know, the running and push-ups and sit-ups every day than I am now outside the military. So, yeah, there are a lot of valuable qualities that you can certainly gain from serving in the U.S. military.
James, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Great. James Yee is a former U.S. Army Muslim chaplain who was stationed at Guantanamo Bay. His book about his time there is called For God and Country, and he's in Wisconsin this weekend for the 2013 Veterans for Peace National Convention. You'll find a link on our Facebook page, which is 45 North on Wisconsin Public, actually 45 North on WPR. And don't forget to friend us while you're there. I'm Ann Strainchamps, and you're listening to 45 North on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you.